Every Monday in December, we're looking at the top science news from 2015. So far, we've talked about astronomy, anthropology, and archaeology, some physics in there. Now it's time for some fun stuff. We're taking a look at the top pop science stories with Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, happy New Year to you and everyone listening.
And happy almost New Year to you as well. Well, I want to take us back to earlier in 2015. There's a viral thing all over social media. The dress. Remind us what the dress was.
Oh my gosh. Can I just tell you, we all kind of assumed those 15 minutes of fame for this photo were over, but no, science has gotten hold of it. You may remember, if you're like me, your Facebook feed blew up last spring when everyone started talking about this dress. People just arguing about this blue and a black dress, and then people would say just as passionately, no, what's wrong with you? It's white and gold.
Right, these are not subtle gradations of color. People think
exactly.
It's blue and black, or white and gold.
Right, and it wasn't like a colorblind thing. It wasn't, you know, any kind of bias that it seemed obvious, but people just felt so passionately about what they were seeing. And it went crazy. I mean, it really broke the internet, as they say. So finally, we thought, you know, then it died down and it went away and it was just a thing. But then science got hold of it. And color analysts, people who research how color vision works in our species, realize this is the first time ever we have a documented incident of people perceiving something so differently. And so they really started researching it, and their preliminary results, which were published in June, are fascinating.
So this viral thing, goofy thing, actually tells us something important about the way our brains and I guess our eyes perceive color. What are scientists saying we're learning from this?
Yeah, well, they're just theories right now. But one of the things they noticed the majority of people do see the dress as blue and black, which it actually is.
Right, you see it on a model, like against a human skin tone.
Right.
It's clearly blue and black.
Right, and about a third of the population sees the dress consistently as white and gold, which is, you know, a very different thing. And when I say see the dress as, I'm talking about the original photo. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. It's not the dress itself. It's the original photo, which was taken with a smartphone of a window display through the window. Now, that actual photo, the dress has a completely ambiguous lighting situation. And that's really key to the science behind this, because the dress was exposed in the photo to natural light. It was in a window display, you know, but it was also lit by artificial light from the store itself. And that is really the key, because we all have a different bias based on the kind of light we are used to being exposed to. So, for example, one theory is that early risers, people who tend to get a lot of natural light, they saw the dress as white and gold because their bias is to correct for color in a natural light setting. But night owls actually tended to see the dress as blue and black, and that's because they're usually exposed to artificial light more so than, you know, early risers. So they actually corrected, you know, their brains corrected for artificial lighting. So it's really fascinating. There's some disagreement about exactly why people perceive it differently, but most researchers agree it has to do with your natural bias. Now, exactly how that bias formed, that's what's really open to debate. But it's just a fascinating and fun thing to talk about, quite frankly.
Fascinating and fun and a little unsettling, because I assume that red is red. And for those who use words like chartreuse and magenta, they are always going to mean the same thing. What we're learning here is that, at least in some situations, our brains are filtering and processing and color correcting in ways that may make us disagree with each other about what a color is.
Exactly. Isn't that crazy?
Well, I want to move to another visual phenomenon now with a tactile. It's going to reach to two senses. This year, a new kind of hologram was created. So hologram, these 3D light images. We saw one of Tupac at an award ceremony some years back. They're big in Star Wars movies. But now there's one that we might be able to feel and interact with. So talk us through this, Gemma.
Yeah, well, this young Japanese researcher showed off what's the first airborne hologram. Now, that means it's not, you know, against the screen or whatever. It's there in 3D. And you can actually touch it. You can feel it when you touch it. And by touching it, you can manipulate it. The way he figured out how to do this actually sounds kind of scary, but he found a way to precisely focus infrared laser light and to have it pulse at a ridiculous ridiculously fast speed. Because if this particular laser is pulsing at nanoseconds, which, you know, is like a hundredth of a second, it'll burn your finger. Mm-hmm. But he figured out if he got it to pulse in femtoseconds, those are quadrillionths of a second, so we're talking teeny, 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 tiny seconds, it actually, you can feel it without it really hurting or damaging your finger. And you can, you know, like, it stir it up and make it move and stuff, and it feels, he says, like sandpaper. So it's a little bit of a tingling sensation, and I have to say that tingling sensation is actually coming from the laser ionizing your skin surface and turning it into plasma, which is kind of scary, but it's not going to damage your skin because it's so short and quick.
So I'm not thinking I'm going to run out and buy this as a kid's toy, Gemma, right off the bat. If, you know, because I wouldn't perceive the difference between leaving it on for a quadrillionth of a second and a nanosecond. Is it a billionth?
Yeah, well, that's how fast the laser pulses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can think of it, if you've ever grabbed something or touched a hot pot on the stove, if you touch it for just the briefest second to appreciate that, hey, I shouldn't touch this, it's hot, it's not really going to burn you. But if you really grab it and hold it for longer, it's going to burn you. It's kind of the same principle. But he's gotten it to pulse much faster so that it's safer. He says. And he's thinking about, you know, side of maybe having, I don't know, Tupac in your living room in a way that, I don't know, maybe you could, you know, reach out and touch him. He's still working out the details, this researcher. But he's thinking big. He's thinking this could be like a stadium event size thing at some point in his lifetime.
Right. This is a 28-year-old scientist. So he's envisioning a new mode of entertainment that we might have thought as a science fiction thing, holodeck from Star Trek or something like that.
Exactly. And he's also talking about maybe for roads and for runways, creating different kinds of markers that would be a little easier to see, especially in weather like we've got today in Wisconsin. And so he's all these applications for it. Right now, he's just got this little tiny little kind of globe that you can poke with your finger, and it's really minute. It's, you know, kind of pinhead size. But he's taking it big. So we'll see where he goes in the next few years with this.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. We're continuing our December roundup of the top news stories from the worlds of science and technology. Well, here's a big one for dinosaur fans, Gemma. The Brontosaurus is back. So first tell us why it went away.
Well, okay, we all know and love Brontosaurus, but for a long time there was this argument that Brontosaurus was not an actual species, that it was cobbled together kind of at the end of the 19th century when there was this huge, huge push to find fossils, especially in the American West and in places like China. There was this huge push to find fossils, not as big a push to study them really rigorously. So a lot of species kind of got named and then unnamed. Brontosaurus was one of them. And paleontologists from about 1903 on said, yeah, it's not a real species. It's just a piece of an apatosaurus from here, piece of another sauropod from there. So I think because Brontosaurus has such a cute, friendly image, we kind of held him dear in our hearts, even though he was disgraced. This young paleontologist decided, well, I'm going to analyze the entire family that Brontosaurus belongs to, and I'm going to do it by looking at every single fragmentary fossil ever found, and then using this very sophisticated statistical analysis to look at them in a way they've never been looked at before. He didn't set out to bring Brontosaurus back, by the way. He was just really trying to analyze this family of the long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs that we call sauropods. And so he did this, and as he was doing it, he realized that all these very clear differences were emerging between the Brontosaurus fossils, the previously called Brontosaurus fossils, and other fossils like Apatosaurus. And just based on the statistical analysis and the number of variables he found between the fossils, he said, yeah, Brontosaurus is actually a legitimate species. So it's yay, it's real again.
Well, yay for that. And actually one of the things I liked most about that story, you had a quote, I think it was from that researcher or somebody involved in it, saying part of the story here isn't just about the Brontosaurus, but about how we should think of science, that we shouldn't think this bit of science is done and we could put that on the shelf and now we're going to move on to the next bit, but rather science is this ongoing conversation where we have to keep revisiting the things we know or think we know.
Yeah, and what I find really fascinating about this researcher, he is actually testing his results right now, and he's using live lizards. He's going to do the same statistical analysis on a live lizard family and then use DNA to kind of check himself. And that's, he's just really kind of trying to punch holes in his own theory. And that's how science works when it's at its best. So it's really fascinating stuff.
Well, I want to wrap up on one of your favorite stories. Researchers have found the oldest known dental procedures in humans. What do we got?
Yes, I have to say it's one of my favorite stories because I love horrifying people. I really do. But it's one of my favorites because every time I explain the story to my colleagues here at Discover, the reaction I got was basically a shriek of horror. And I also want to say I really feel for this guy, for this 14,000-year-old guy. We know it's a guy that they found his skeleton in a cave in northern Italy. And they realized that one of his teeth had all these marks on it. So they did some very sophisticated analysis, including using modern teeth that had been extracted. They tried to replicate the marks on modern teeth. They realized he took a sharp stone tool, he or maybe one of his buddies, and was basically hacking away at an infection in his tooth. This is the first and earliest evidence of dentistry that we have. Previously, we had about a 9,000-year-old record that someone was meddling with a tooth trying to get the, you know, infection out, but this is 14,000 years old. And if you just picture the poor guy, you know, trying to get rid of this infection, your heart goes out to him. But yeah, he was partially successful, I can say, and he survived. He lived beyond the infection, so, you know, he's got that going for him. But if you dread going to the dentist, just think, be glad they're not using stone tools anymore.
Well, it's an amazing story. I mean, 14,000 years ago, probably some nomadic hunter-gatherer group, trial and error, or for all we know, this is one we found. Maybe they had an established system of dental procedures. Like, oh, you got that cavity, you're going in there with the stone scraper. Maybe this wasn't the only guy who did this.
Yeah, you know, it could well be. It could well be. Every year we find out fascinating things, and we really change the timelines that we thought we knew. But for right now, you know, my heart goes out to this poor guy 14,000 years ago, and I just love the reaction I get from people when I tell them.
Well, a visit to the dentist, you're right, Gemma, doesn't sound so bad now. Thanks, as always, and we're looking forward to talking to you in 2016.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That's Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She was with us to talk about the coolest pop science stories of 2015, and she joins us pretty much every month here on Central Time for a look at the latest in the worlds of science and technology.